MacCast, Saturday, October 19th, 2019. Hey, MacGeeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for MacGeeks by MacGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things MacDash. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. I hope you are having a great week, weekend, whatever it might be as you receive this podcast. It's always a weird thing to start this. I never know when you're actually listening. Could be any time, because that's the nature of podcasts and why we love them, right? So anyway, want to get into a bunch of Apple Mac news. As always, we got some great things to talk about this week. We're going to be getting into some information about Apple's new modems, interesting development with Apple TV production, and Apple maybe expanding some of what they're doing there. We've got updated rumors surrounding the next affordable iPhone, and some updates to Catalina, and also a little bit of an update on potential new AirPods. So we got all that to get to in the news, and then we have a bunch of great feedback and comments from you. We're going to talk about the growing size of macOS, get into how you might be able to find some of those older Mac installers in case you need to get your hands on those. It's not always easy to do. We'll give you a tip and trick on how to find that. We'll talk a little bit about Apple Card and fraud. Also, that curious folder that some people have emailed me about that appeared on their desktop after upgrading to macOS Catalina. We'll get into what that's all about and what you might be able to do about it or not do about it. And then a tip on reminders, and also we'll try to help a listener out with some file recovery. And that will round out this episode of the MacCast. So lots of great things to get into. But of course, as always, before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, and that is Smile. We love Smile here at the MacCast, and I want to talk to you this week about PDF Pen, one of my favorite Smile applications, something I use all the time, because if you're like me, you deal a lot with PDFs. And PDF Pen 11 is really the ultimate tool for editing PDFs on your Mac. And it's got a bunch of great new features. You can do cool things like add headers and footers into your documents. You can put in watermarks if you need to protect stuff. They also have great tools, including precision editing tools. Plus, it can OCR your documents, meaning that your PDFs are then searchable in Spotlight. You can find all the information inside the app. In PDF Pen 11, they have a bunch of great new features. One of my favorite is support for continuity camera. That means that you can snap images with your iPhone and bring them right into PDF Pen. They also have a new split view editing mode, which makes editing PDFs even more efficient and great. You can edit your documents on your Mac, on the iPad, on the iPhone. PDF Pen supports file syncing with all the popular cloud services. I like to use iCloud, but you can pick your own. And PDF Pen for iPad, iPhone 5 supports iOS 13. So if you've upgraded, you don't have to worry about that. And it syncs seamlessly with PDF Pen 11 on your Mac. So you have your documents where and when you want them. And if you jump up to PDF Pen Pro 11, it has a bunch of great advanced features. One of my favorites is the ability to take a, what I call fake PDF form, a form that is a PDF just with like lines that you would normally fill out, but not real PDF fillable fields. Yeah, you can take that and with PDF Pen Pro 11, automatically convert that into a fillable form. It also has great features like the ability to export to Excel or PowerPoint. So if you need to get into one of those formats from a PDF, yep, they make it super easy. It is great software, something I have on every single one of my Macs and iOS devices, and I wouldn't live without. You can check it out and get more information and details at smilesoftware.com/podcast. And we thank them, as always, for their continued support of the MacCast. We certainly have had a lot of discussion and comments and debate surrounding Apple's cellular modems, 5G. Are they going to bring 5G to the iPhone in 2018? Are they going to bring it in 2020. When are we going to see a 5G modem in an iPhone? Well, we know it didn't happen in 2019 because of all the events with Qualcomm and Intel and all those sorts of things. But now we are getting a lot more information about when we might actually see Apple make their own modems. There's been a lot of discussion about the fact that they wanted to make their own 5G modems, but the question of exactly when they would actually put one out has always been a little bit up in the air. There's been everything from 2020 all the way through 2025. Well, this week, latest reports from Fast Company are citing a, quote, source familiar with Apple's plans. They say that the company wants to have their own 5G modems ready for delivery and in devices by 2022. That would be an extremely aggressive and tight timeline, given the fact that Apple would need to get a number of worldwide certifications and authorizations. You have to go through a lot of red tape to get a new cellular modem on a device and into public use. It's not an easy thing to do. So that would be aggressive. Can Apple pull it off, though, is the question. And they probably can, because they've built up an amazing in-house team of cellular experts, acquiring a lot of talent from places like Qualcomm and Intel. Apple had also been working closely with Intel when they had their modem business on a next-gen XMM 8165G modem. But as we know now, Intel ran into quite a bit of trouble putting that together, ultimately causing Apple to lose a little faith in them and settle their ongoing lawsuits with Qualcomm so that they would be able to get access to 5G modems in 2021 or in 2020, excuse me. And we are expecting Apple to use Qualcomm modems then. And not long after they did that settlement, Intel announced that it was going to be shuttering its modem business and selling off the assets. Apple actually picked up a lot of the talent from that sale, along with a bunch of key cellular patents that really pushed forward their own internal 5G modem efforts, or just cellular modem efforts. Again, they had been working on this for a while. So it's believed ultimately Apple's 5G modem solution will eventually be integrated into their A-series chip as part of a system-on-a-chip design. That might not happen right away in 2022, but what could happen is Apple could release a standalone 5G chip for the iPhone in 2022 and then bring an integrated solution not long after, possibly as soon as 2023. But the point then becomes, some of the rumors that we had been hearing that Apple could have a 5G modem, their own 5G modem in their devices by 2021, that's looking not very likely, or by 2020, excuse me. I keep wanting to jump ahead a year. 2020 is next year's iPhone, and we're not expecting to see an Apple modem in there then, probably Qualcomm, and probably Qualcomm in 2021, but maybe, just maybe, by 2022, Apple will have its own modems. And I would be surprised. We're saying 5G, or a lot of these reports are saying 5G. Wouldn't we be almost to maybe 6G or whatever the next generation is by then? Regardless, that's when Apple would have potentially their own chipsets. And as we know, Apple likes to design their own chips, build their own chips, kind of be in control of their own destiny. So we do expect it to happen eventually. And it's looking right now that the best guesstimation is maybe by 2020. Again, if they're very aggressive and work very, very hard, but hey, we know Apple does that all the time. And speaking of being in charge of your own destiny and in control of your own content, Marvel did it, so why couldn't Apple? What do you think about Apple Studios? I think we've talked about this in the past as well, that if Apple did get into doing a streaming service, how long would it be before they would start making their own original content? And we know Apple is making original shows, but to date, they've all been announced and are being produced by partnerships with other companies. Well, this week we heard from The Hollywood Reporter that Apple is going to launch, guess what? Its own in-house studio with a project that will be the third in a series of World War II dramas originally done by HBO. HBO produced the shows, or the series rather, Band of Brothers and the Pacific. Apple's new series will expand on that and be titled Masters of the Air. It is the story of the men of the 8th Air Force, also known as the Men of the Mighty 8th. And just like the previous HBO series, the show will be produced by Tom Hanks, Gary Gottesman, and Steven Spielberg. So some big powerhouses behind this new effort. This will be the first show done for Apple TV Plus by Apple's own in-house studio. Seems like not a bad place to start, right? I mean, if you're going to start your own studio, getting Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks on board, yeah, that's probably a good thing. Not only that, picking up a series that will expand upon two highly acclaimed, highly successful series, that's probably a good call as well. Band of Brothers in the Pacific combined both won 14 Emmy Awards. So this is looking to be pretty good. The studio is going to be run by former Sony studio executives Zach Van Amberg and Jeremy Ehrlicht, who are also the guys who have been heading up Apple's worldwide video efforts. So these are the guys basically responsible for putting Apple TV Plus together and all of the existing shows. They're going to be running this studio, and I am pretty excited about this. I actually loved Band of Brothers. I actually own the series on DVD. And honestly, I didn't realize they had done this Pacific, so I am going to be going into HBO to watch that series as well. I bet you it's excellent. And this one sounds just as great and could be a great kickoff start for Apple's efforts. Now, that said, I do have one little area of concern, and this goes way, way back to when Apple announced that they were getting into music and getting into iTunes and all of that stuff. I expressed concerns that Apple, as a consumer electronics company, could eventually end up like Sony in the 80s. Sony was a huge consumer electronics powerhouse and making a lot of really great killer products, and then they started to really broadly expand into other areas that felt outside their wheelhouse, and I felt like Sony's electronics brand suffered a little bit, and I think there's other people who would agree with me on that. Now, that said, Sony is not a bad company in this day and age, especially on the backs of the PlayStation, so there is a way out, but I always worry that Apple is getting a little bit too diversified in their efforts. Now, every time they prove me wrong, and they turn out to just be a powerhouse in a field, and I think this one, the big difference here is that they hired a lot of extremely good talent from that industry. They are hiring the right people to kind of run this, and I think it's really being run almost as a separate effort outside of what's going on in Cupertino. Yes, they're keeping a close eye on it from what we know, but I have a little less concerns. But it is interesting that way back when I predicted that this might be the trajectory for Apple, that they could eventually start to do a movie or a television studio, and lo and behold, here we are. So it was a lot later than I originally expected, but it happened anyway. Also in Apple TV Plus news, it looks like some of the shows that Apple is already producing or working with partners to produce that are going to be their launch titles have been renewed for second seasons. For All Mankind, Dickinson, Little America, and Home Before Dark all received a second series order this week, or at least we heard about it this week, and they will join the morning show, which already had a second series order and is ready to go. An interesting thing about the morning show that came up this week, too, is that Apple is spending a little over $15 million per episode to produce that. That is actually more per episode reportedly than was spent on episodes of Game of Thrones, which is just crazy. A lot of that money going to the talent, Jennifer Aniston and Reese Witherspoon, who are reportedly getting, I think, about $1.25 million per episode. So, you know, Apple not afraid to spend a little bit of money on their content, and we don't have much longer to wait before we get to get a glimpse at how well that money has been spent. November 1st is the launch for Apple TV Plus. I'm looking forward to it. Of course, anybody who's recently bought an iPhone or an iPad or an Apple TV, you're going to get a free year of access, and the streaming service will cost just $4.99 a month, which, as we've talked about in the past, I think was a great price point and a great deal. And I am looking forward to it. Of course, we'll be sharing my thoughts and opinions on all of the release stuff with Apple TV after it comes out in November. Another interesting thing about Apple TV Plus is you don't have to just have an Apple device to watch it. As we know, Apple announced that they were going to be partnering with a bunch of TV manufacturers to have an Apple TV app put on their smart TVs, and also that the Apple TV app would eventually be coming to Roku. Well, eventually is this past week, because the Apple TV app was released on Roku. It can be downloaded now from the Roku channel store. So if you have one of those devices and you want to use the Apple TV app, you can grab that now. And I think that's pretty cool. I think this is the smart thing to do, especially as Apple moves into streaming services and as they are trying to grow their streaming business. I think availability on alternative devices is a really good thing. And ultimately, you know, a lot of people worry, well, won't that hurt Apple TV sales? And I have a feeling that the folks who buy a Roku are not the same folks who would want to buy an Apple TV and vice versa. So expansion, I'd like to see Apple actually move more things into Android. I think the number one thing a lot of us would like to see them do is the Messages app on Android. I think that wouldn't be a bad move on Apple's part either. And so this kind of expansion I like seeing. And so I was pretty excited to hear that, yep, the Roku app is available. So if you have a Roku device and you are using the TV app on it, I don't own one. So maybe someone in our community can provide us a little review. If you want to send an audio review, a 2 or 3 minute long review would be great, to how you're enjoying the app on Roku, or how maybe how even how the experience is good or different from what we get on our Apple devices. Send it along, maccast@gmail.com. And then finally, one other little Apple TV thing that came up this week that was very interesting, and it was surprising this was something that wasn't caught in iFixit's Apple TV 4K teardown, but a Twitter user seems to have discovered a hidden diagnostic port, a lightning port, on the Apple TV 4K. And if you're thinking, Adam, I have an Apple TV 4K, and I remember that Apple used to include a USB port, a little micro USB port on the back of their devices, or a lightning port on the back of their devices for diagnostics and for the ability to connect to iTunes and do software restores and stuff like that. But that's gone in the Apple TV 4K. You would be correct. That was the general consensus until this guy figured out that deep, deep inside the back of the Ethernet port, hidden, is a little lightning connector. Now, it's not clear how you would actually connect to it. I would presume that Apple in-house has some sort of special cable or some sort of special device to get that in there. And it's not entirely clear what it's used for or if it's even used at all. It could be, too, that you would take off the case, although I believe when I went to look at the iFixit teardown that there was full metal shielding around the Ethernet port. So it sounds like you'd have to go in through the front some way, but a standard lightning cable will definitely not reach. Even Apple's one with kind of the narrow housing, plastic housing around the lightning connector, yep, that one won't go in there. So I'm sure many people, now that they're aware of it, will go in and play around with it, and we'll probably get more details about what potential capabilities are. Are there any end user applications? Probably not. Again, this is probably purely something for Apple when they're servicing the Apple TV. But still, I thought it was very interesting. And it, you know, Apple does have a history of kind of putting little hidden diagnostic ports into their products in various ways. As a matter of fact, I think Stephen Troughton Smith on his website actually has some articles or some things he's written up about that entire history. So if you want to know more about it, check out his site. But that was pretty cool this week to see that that discovery. Seems like we've had rumor after rumor after rumor about Apple potentially doing an update for the iPhone SE and iPhone SE 2, and it's sounding more and more like that is an inevitability, although it might not be the iPhone that you're looking for, especially if a small size is the number one feature that you want in an iPhone SE. And that is really what I think most people want. But this rumor has been going around for a while. This week, Ming-Chi Kuo added some extra detail in a note to his investors, specifically about some of the specifications of the potential updated model. He's saying that it will feature an A-series A13 processor, just like the iPhone 11. It'll come with 3 gigabytes of RAM, be offered in two sizes, 64 gigabytes and 128 gigabytes, and come in 3 different colors, space gray, silver, and red. He doesn't give any more details than that in terms of the specs, no mention of the camera system that it will have. I would hope it would actually adopt a dual-lens camera system like the iPhone X, but Apple might just stick with a single-lens system, the single-lens system that you see on the iPhone 8. And the reason that I say that is the kicker in the Ming-Chi Kuo piece is that he thinks the package is going to have the same design and form factor as the iPhone 8. So not really an iPhone SE 2 at all. It is expected to come with Apple's entry-level price point starting around $399 US, but not really this small size, which is, I think, what most people think about when they think about an iPhone SE 2. So I have a feeling there's going to be some disappointments. I think the overall goal for Apple, though, is really that price point, getting an entry-level price point for an iPhone. And it's interesting that they would go with a number of specs that would put it right in line with, say, the iPhone 11. So maybe they stick with the single-lens camera system just to give it a little bit more differentiation and to justify that lower starting point. As far as when we will see the updated iPhone 8 SE 2, as I'm going to call it, it's expected to arrive sometime in the first quarter of next year. So if you're looking for a more affordable iPhone upgrade and you don't want to spend the extra money on iPhone 11 over the holiday season, sometime at the beginning of next year, you might have an additional option. Sticking with the iPhone news, we got some more information about the performance of Apple's new iPhone 11 Pro and that new A13 processor. And not surprising, it's a nice little bump up from the A12. They put the processor through its paces for their in-depth interview. I'll have a link to that in the show notes at mattkast.com if you want to check out the full thing. They get into a lot of technical nitty-gritty, so if that's your jam, that's definitely worth checking out. But they found the CPU to be about 20% faster than the A12, although they did note that it draws a little bit more power at peak performance in order to achieve that. So a little more energy hungry when you're trying to push it to the limits than the A12. But overall, not a detriment, apparently, because they found that the A13 is about 30% more energy efficient than the A12. Now, when they got into the GPU, performance got even a little bit better. Under peak performance, about a 20% improvement, just like the CPU, but they found the iPhone 11 Pro had a 50 to 60% higher sustained performance in its graphics capabilities. So when you're really pushing it to its limits for a sustained period of time, it tends to hold up a lot better and perform better than the A12. And that's probably going to come across a lot in games or other things like photo video processing, and probably helps out a lot too with some of the new video features and the new camera features on the iPhone. So not that surprising, but overall, nice little bump up from last year's A12 processor. And again, if you want to get more details on all of that, check out the Anand Tech article. If you ask a lot of people, myself included, I would say that the launch of Apple's latest operating system, Mac OS Catalina, has been a little bit rocky. There were some bumps and little issues. Nothing huge or major, I don't think, for most folks. I shared some of my problems and issues and things that I ran into in the last episode of the MacCast. I'm happy to report that since then I haven't encountered too many additional problems, but the upgrade didn't go as smoothly as you probably would have liked, or I would have liked at least. But it's looking like Apple is working pretty quick to fix some of the issues. They already came out with a supplemental update to Mac OS Catalina this week. The fix is for issues like ones that I had where the setup assistant actually hung up during installation. I actually had to reboot my Mac and it turned out everything was okay, but I got to the setup for screen time and it just literally froze. I will tell you that the supplemental update I did install it this week, and you probably want to be patient with this one as well. I launched it. It did take a while for the update to happen, and there were a few moments where I got a little bit worried. I thought it might be hung up again. It took a long time. I just let it run. I stepped back, stepped away, did some other things, and I would advise you to do the same. Eventually did finish up. And I think overall, I want to say it took about 20 to 30 minutes for me to run the update. I don't know if that's a typical experience or just what I experienced, but I'm just sharing that with you. And if you were worried about Catalina or you had issues, again, there's some nice little updates in here. Another big one that I heard from a lot of listeners about was the iCloud login loop issue. They added a fix for that. So what was happening was for some users, it would get stuck on the iCloud terms and conditions. It sounds like this is the case if you had multiple iCloud accounts set up on your Mac, maybe if you're using multiple users. I wasn't really sure how you did that. Maybe different accounts for iTunes versus iCloud, but I run like that and I didn't run into this problem. But basically there were a number of people who reported getting stuck in this continuous loop where the machine would keep asking them to log into iCloud. That should be resolved with the supplemental update as well. In addition, they added improvements to the reliability of macOS Catalina on Macs with low disk space and improved the reliability of saving Game Center data when playing Apple Arcade games offline. So this update is out and available. You can get it through Software Update, and I would grab it this week because, again, it sounds like there's a little bit of bugginess in Catalina. I'm not going to lie, and it's good to see that Apple is quickly rolling out updates. I will tell you another thing, and I'm just adding this. This wasn't even in the show notes, but it's something that I did think about this week, and that's the fact that I'm not so sure that forcing your developers to stick to a sort of yearly update cycle for your operating system is necessarily a good thing. We've had this for a few years now, and some updates are okay and some are less okay, but it kind of feels like we don't have those great updates anymore where you run a macOS update and everything runs just fine. A lot of people won't even upgrade on day one because of it. I was in that camp until Catalina, and then I rolled the dice this time around, mostly so that I could talk to you about my experiences on this podcast. But it did get me thinking, you know, maybe it's time for Apple to roll back on this concept of releasing a operating system on a schedule. As a developer, I know that's a very hard thing to do. It kind of doesn't make for a very great, fun working environment, especially as you get to crunch time, as you get to that release schedule. You would hope that Apple is maybe rolling back features when they realize something's not going to make it, but it almost feels like they should move back to the release cycle of we'll put it out when it's done and ready to go. And I think that would lead to a better customer experience. I'm not implying or saying that Catalina is really bad. It didn't have that many issues. They were kind of minor, and I haven't seen any really big breaking problems. I guess there is some people experiencing a little bit of a mail problem where mail is, if you move mail between folders, in some instances, it's losing copies of your email, which is pretty bad. Knock on wood, I don't think I've experienced that bug, but just another thing to be aware of if you're considering a Catalina upgrade. Yeah, they have some kinks to work out. And I just wonder if they should move away from that cycle. So that's just a thought I had this week. Some of you probably agree with me. Maybe a lot of you agree with me. I don't know. Let me know what you think about that. Shoot me an email and an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. And then finally in the news for this week, a little update on what could potentially be the next generation AirPods, maybe even AirPods Pro. We've been talking about Apple maybe bringing noise cancellation. We saw that little icon that showed maybe there's a new design. Well, China Economic Daily reports this week that Apple's third generation AirPods are being readied and could be launched as early as the end of October. They will have a new in-ear design, supposedly, with kind of rubber ear tips and a noise canceling feature. Now, here's the rub, though. They're probably going to be called AirPods Pro, meaning that they're going to adopt the new Pro labeling that Apple seems so fond of lately, but also adopt, along with it, that new Pro price tag. They're saying US $260. Ouch, that is quite a bit more, $60 more, in fact, for what is potentially the new AirPods. I guess it's really going to depend on how good that noise cancellation is, whether it's worth that kind of money. I already found it pretty hard to justify $200 for a set of AirPods with a wireless charging case. I know you can get them without the wireless charging case for $159 right now. But, you know, that's not cheap for a set of headphones. And it's a hard sell for a lot of people. So these things better sound darn good. I mean, I love my AirPods. Don't get me wrong. I think they are one of the greatest products that Apple's put out in a while. And a lot of people really love them. But more and more these days, it seems like Apple's premium pricing is getting even more premium. And it's harder. It's hard on your wallet, right? Let's just admit it. We have to say that. I love the products, and I probably will get a set of these if they come out. But ouch. There is a separate report also claiming that they might have a new metal design, which is interesting. And they're saying part of the reason for that is to increase heat dissipation. I thought about that, and I thought, wait a minute. These things are in my ears. Do I really want a lot of heat dissipation coming out of them? But metal would be cool. Yeah, I'd like a set of metal, and that would fall more in line with the Pro moniker as well. Maybe they'll even be titanium, or at the very least, probably recycled aluminum, knowing Apple. But new AirPods, we could hear about it at the October announcement. I still am expecting Apple to have a end of month October announcement. It's getting towards crunch time, though. I would think invites or information should go out probably next week if they are going to do something on the 30th or maybe even the 29th of October. So hopefully we'll hear about that next week. And with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another show sponsor, and that is Linode. Hey, if you're looking at needing to do some hosting, you want to put up a new website, or maybe you want to set up a new gaming server, take a look at Linode. They have some really great options, and they give you a lot of great choices. If you like variety, you like choice, you like being able to custom configure your stuff, I think Linode is the number one hosting service for doing that. Linode allows you to instantly deploy and manage an SSD server in their Linode cloud. You can get up and running literally in seconds, and you get your choice of Linux distribution, resources, and choice of hosting location with 10 different node locations to choose from. And best of all, they're giving all new Maccast customers a $20 credit. I used my Linode to set up a Minecraft server because I'm kind of really into Minecraft, and they made it so easy. They have one-click gaming installs, so you could do that for Minecraft. You can also set up Ark, Terraria, other games, and if you want to host something like WordPress, they make that easy. Drupal, you want to set up a GitLab version control server, one click there, and also OpenVPN if you want to set up your own secure VPN on your own server. And they offer a bunch of different Linux distributions. Basically, if it runs on Linux, it runs on Linode. Most are out of the box, but you can custom upload your own image and create your own. Like I said, a lot of choice, a lot of variety. Basically, build the server you want. They feature native SSD storage, a 40 gigabit network, and industry-leading processors. You can pick any of their 10 worldwide data centers, and they just opened a new one in Toronto, Canada, and they're going to be adding an additional data center in Mumbai, India by the end of 2019. Their pricing is simple too, with no surprise fees. You pay for what you use with hourly billing across all of their plans and add-on services. You can get started with what you need for just about $5 a month on their Nanode plans, and you can go all the way up to high-powered dedicated CPU plans if you want. And their dashboard makes it really easy to manage those Linodes and makes upgrading your plan super, super easy. And you can add on backups, large storage volumes, load balancing, you name it, they have what you want. And they back all of that up with some great 24/7 live customer support. And they have a large documentation library. So if you need self-help, they make that easy and painless as well. Visit linode.com/maccast to set up your first Linode and get a $20 credit when you use the promo code maccast2019. That's linode.com/maccast and maccast2019 for that $20 credit. Huge thank you to Linode for their support of the Maccast. Last week, I told you a little bit about my macOS Catalina installation experience. I also mentioned that one of the things that I like to do when I install a new version of macOS is download the installer and build a USB stick as a recovery disk. You know, Apple doesn't give out disks anymore, so what you can do is you can build a USB installer. The one thing that I didn't tell you about, though, is that I did run into a little issue with that, because I have a certain size USB stick lying around, and it didn't exactly work the first time around, and there's a reason for that, and I wasn't the only person to experience this. Michael also experienced it and sent me a voicemail about it, and so we're kind of both thinking maybe it's not so much macOS Catalina as it is macOS Fatalina.
Hi, Adam. This is Mike from Massachusetts, and I just wanted to share a little something about the bootable USB image for macOS Catalina. In the past, Apple had always recommended an 8-gig flash drive for making the bootable images. And several years ago, I had purchased a 16-gigabyte flash disk and partitioned it down the middle so I could have the current and past installer available to me at any time. And like most of us, when we get a little older, macOS has put on a little weight. So the Catalina image seems to be coming in at about 8.16 gigabytes and no longer fits on the 8 gigabyte flash disk. So you need a little bit more space, and I guess I'll be off to finding a slightly larger flash stick, or maybe a much larger flash stick. I hope somebody finds this useful, and thank you for all you do. Bye.
I found it useful, and I think a lot of people will find it useful, Michael. Yeah, it's good to know that it doesn't fit on an 8 gigabyte stick anymore, because that's where it was for a long, long time. I was just like you. I had a bunch of these 8 gig sticks that I bought. I wasn't doing the partition thing, which actually, that's a great tip as well, but I had these 8 gig sticks, and I went to format it, install it. The weird thing about it was the installer that you run from the terminal, the command line thing, it seemed to run just fine, and then until it got to a point, and then it gave me some sort of cryptic error. That didn't really indicate that it wasn't big enough, but I had a suspicion that it might have been the size of my USB stick. So I ended up going out and purchasing some new, I like to buy the Kingston Data Traveler drives. They're the SE9 G2 drives, USB 3.0 drives, and that was what my 8 gig drives were. This time around, I gave myself a little bit more room for future expansion. I bought 10 new 64 gigabyte Kingston Data Traveler USB sticks in a pack through Amazon, and I think they ran about $80 for all 10 of them. So it was pretty good deal, about $8 each for a 64 gig, and that should last me into the future. But thanks for sending that in. I forgot to actually mention that in my review, and it's pretty important because there's probably a lot of people out there that maybe have smaller USB sticks that worked in the past and are wondering, like I was, why are they no longer working? So thank you for sending in your voicemail. Speaking of those macOS installers, a lot of times when you're installing the new one, it's not a problem because you go to the App Store and boom, it's right there, right? You can find macOS Catalina. As a matter of fact, Apple's pretty aggressive about putting it in our face. If you look in your system preferences and you're running macOS Sierra or High Sierra or Mojave or something like that, you probably see in software update a little micro ad, yeah, in your system preferences for upgrading to macOS Catalina. But what if you don't want to upgrade to that? Or what if you have an older Mac? Or what if you want to download and create a USB installer for an older version of a Mac operating system? Well, things have changed a little bit in macOS Catalina because the App Store app is a little bit different. And one thing I noticed, and several of you noticed because you emailed me, is that the App Store no longer shows the old operating systems in the purchased section. It used to be that you could go to the macOS purchase section, or I think in even some cases you could search the App Store and you could find an older installer fairly easily. It wasn't right up front. You couldn't really browse to it, but you could get to it. Now, if you do it, though, in macOS Catalina, it's not there. As a matter of fact, a couple of people emailed me about this, and that's how I found out about it. I started to look, and I was really surprised. I also then went and did some Googling and some searching to try and figure out how we solve this problem. Luckily, it's not too bad. Turns out that Apple has an article on their support website called How to Create a Bootable Installer for macOS. I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. So not only does it tell you how you can create a bootable installer, but right within that article, they have links to pages for how to do this for the various operating systems, macOS Catalina, all the way back to macOS 10 El Capitan. And if you click on one of those articles and scroll down a little bit, you can find the appropriate download link for that macOS. And oddly enough, it's a direct link to the page on the Mac App Store. So when you click it, it will launch the Mac App Store on your Mac and go right to that page. What's really annoying about that, in my opinion, is why then can't I search for that in the Mac App Store? Why can't I just search in the Mac App Store, open it up and say Mac OS 10 El Capitan and find that? That does not work. And probably be my luck that Apple changes that after you hear this episode and it turns out that you can. But I tested this before recording this episode and it did not work for me. The only way I could find these pages was by going to that article on Apple's website and then finding these individual Mac installers through their individual pages. So if you go there, scroll down the page, look for a link that says get and then the name of the Mac operating system. Click on that, and that's how you can get that installer. And then you can build your own USB install sticks for all of the operating systems. I have mine in a little tin that I keep, USB stick for each one of the operating systems. I think I have mine going all the way back to Lion. Is that what the first version? I don't remember what was the first version where Apple stopped shipping a DVD. I think it might have been Lion. Maybe Mountain Lion. Someone will correct me on that, I'm sure. Look forward to your emails. Something that came up on the MacCast last week was one of the first stories about an Apple Card getting fraud on it. Somebody had used their Apple Card someplace, I don't remember where it was, and it was skimmed, and they had some fraudulent charges show up on their Apple Card. And it was only a story because Apple made such a big deal about the security of Apple Card. Of course, at the end of the day, the physical card is just a credit card and is susceptible, especially with the magstripe, to any other sort of exploit that the magstripe would be susceptible to. So it wasn't a real huge story. And then this week popped up another fraud story with a user saying that there were fraudulent charges on their Apple Card, despite the fact that they had never used the physical card at all to pay for anything. And that was kind of a big story. Unfortunately, I think a lot of people saw that story and didn't get the follow-up story, which was later he remembered that he had used the virtual card number on his Apple Card to make an online purchase at his daughter's school website. And it's very likely that the school website's credit card processing system was compromised or hacked. And that's how his information got out there. So again, anytime you're using an actual physical credit card number, which that virtual number is, you are susceptible to that kind of exposure. It's still a credit card at the end of the day. So none of these things are very surprising, but it did get me thinking we should probably have a conversation about the different ways that you can actually use your Apple Card, the security of each of those things, and just how you get access to things like that virtual card number. I don't know if we covered this when I covered Apple Card here on the MacCast, I think a few months ago. So if you're looking at the different ways you can pay with Apple Card, you kind of have three different options. The first and probably the best, most secure one is Apple Pay. If you use Apple Pay, it does not use a credit card number at all. That is not something that is shared with a retailer. It is not something that is exposed. Basically, it generates a unique number for that transaction and processes it and tells the retailer, yep, it's good. You've got the funds. It's all taken care of. I'm oversimplifying that, but you get the point, right? Apple Pay, if you can use Apple Pay, you're not going to be exposed. Even if that retailer's systems get compromised, they don't have any of the information. They don't have your credit card number. You're not going to be able to have that kind of exploit happen to you. So Apple Pay, probably the number one way you want to use your Apple Card if you can. Number two, of course, is the physical card. It has some security features, like it doesn't have things like the CVV2 number or the card number on the actual physical card. That doesn't mean that it doesn't have a credit card number. It actually does, but you don't even get to see it in the wallet app. You can access and see the last four digits of your Apple Card number. If you tap on the dot, dot, dot from the wallet app after tapping on your Apple Card, the card information section will come up. You have to authenticate with Face ID or Touch ID first, then the card information will come up and you will see an entry for physical card, and then you'll see the last four digits of that number. You can use your physical titanium Apple Card just like a regular credit card. Again, if you're not using the chip, if you're using the magnetic stripe, you know, you're susceptible to the same kinds of exploits. Even with the chip, again, because we don't use a chip and PIN system, especially here in the US, you're going to have a little less security than if you're using Apple Pay. The final way that you can make purchases with your Apple Card is with the Apple Card number that is in the wallet Apple Card, the virtual number. This is the virtual number that gets assigned when you set up your Apple Card. This number does not change unless you physically tell it to change it. So this is kind of the number that you can use if you need to make a phone or an online purchase at a place that does not accept Apple Pay. To see that number, you tap again, you tap on the Apple Card in the wallet, you tap on the dot, 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 and then after you authenticate with Face ID or Touch ID, in the card information section, you will see the card number, the expiration date, the CVV2 code. Now, another nice security feature that your Apple Card has, though, is if you're like the guy in this story and you find out your card number did get breached or compromised, you can request a new card number right from within the wallet app. There's a little link there that says request new card number, and you will get a new virtual card number, CVV2 code, and expiration date. So you can quickly take care of that issue on your own without having to call the credit card company or do anything like that. Now, obviously, if you get a new card number, the old one is no longer valid. So if you set that up for auto payments or any other sorts of things like that, recurring payments, you're going to need to go update all of those places just like you would if you were requesting a second physical card after a breach, right? If you cancel a credit card because it was data breached and you're getting a new physical card, this is the same thing. You're just doing it virtually with the card in your wallet app. But the good news is that the virtual card gets compromised, the card information on your physical Apple Card is not the same, and vice versa. So those are separated, and you can kind of treat them separately. So some nice security features on Apple Card, but just some more information that might be helpful as you're using your Apple Card. There is definitely one feature of macOS Catalina that I think is causing more confusion, more concern than any other that I can think of, at least if you believe the MacCast inbox, and that is the relocated items folder. I think I mentioned this when I did my comments and review of macOS Catalina a couple MacCast episodes ago, but I did receive a lot of emails about this. And if you haven't seen it yet or you don't know what I'm talking about, when you install macOS Catalina, there is a good chance that after your installation, especially if you've used your Mac for a while and gone through several upgrades, there's a good chance that you will see on your desktop an alias or a link to something called relocated items. And the biggest questions I am getting in my email are, what is this thing? And can I safely delete it? I think that's the bigger question, is more people want to know, do I have to keep this thing? Because if you look in there, there's a little PDF and Apple tries to explain what it is, but they don't do a very good job of it. And it's a little bit cryptic. And a lot of the files you might see in there are going to be weird files like system level files and configuration files. And there is a reason for that. So we'll try to answer these two questions. What is it, first of all? As I mentioned, after upgrading to macOS Catalina, you might see this relocated items folder on your desktop. It will contain older files and data from previous macOS installations that can not stay where they are or were in Catalina. So basically, these were files that were within the operating system, were in system folder areas, or were files that were system level files that either you or an application actually modified or changed. And because of the latest security features in macOS Catalina, or more specifically the file system changes, they cannot live in that location. So this is sort of Apple just backing them up. Basically, in Catalina, Apple is finally fully adopting the Apple file system features, the APFS features, and they're using containers that can have multiple volumes, and the system is in one of those containers and your files are in the other. So as part of this setup, the system now lives in its own read-only volume called Macintosh HD, and that's to protect it from having anything else overwrite its files. So it's sort of siloed off there, and then your files and data and everything else are stored separately in another volume called Macintosh HD /data. Now, you yourself are not going to notice this separation at all because it's handled by the APFS system, the Apple file system, and is not visible inside the Finder. It still appears as one continuous giant volume. If you open up Disk Utility, though, and take a look, you will see these two distinct volumes inside the container, basically. And so when you install macOS Catalina, it tries to take everything from your old system and put it in these containers. And that means the old setup is going to get split across these locations, but there might end up being some files or configuration or third-party files that were installed inside the system folder or modified inside the system folder, and they can't live there. And the system tries to move them to the data portion, this data volume, but they don't have locations or directories for that because that's not a system volume. So doesn't know where to put them. It goes, whoop, I need to do something with these. I don't want to just delete them because they may be needed or they may be important. And so they land in the relocated items folder. And I think I mentioned on the last episode of the MacCast, I actually had a couple critical files in here that I did want, and they were Apache and MySQL configuration files. So stuff that I used for my web development. And again, normally those would be files that were modified, basically system level files. And I made some modifications to those. I put in my own configuration settings and whatnot, different from what the default system would normally set up. And so it was saving those for me. And so I was glad that that was there. In a lot of cases, most of you are probably not going to need these files. A lot of them probably date back to older versions of the operating system you had installed at one point, and they were just never cleaned up because maybe you haven't done a clean install in a while, or you had a program and you deleted it. As Apple has changed the security rules and settings, a lot of the configurations and the files and things like that have moved to newer locations, and those probably did get migrated just fine. So you may or may not need these files. In most cases, you're probably not going to need them, but I would say you definitely want to review the contents of this folder and do any research on any of the items that maybe you don't understand, because you know it's easy to forget or not realize that a application or something needs a particular file in a location or something like that. And anytime you upgrade to a new operating system, you might not be opening up and running all of your applications or using all the processes that you usually use on your Mac right away, right? Oftentimes we'll be working and we have maybe an application or something we use infrequently. So there's probably not a lot of files in this folder. They probably don't take up a lot of space. I think the biggest concern for a lot of people is the fact that there is a folder on the desktop. And it just clutters up your desktop. And if you're like me, you like a clean desktop and you don't want to see that there. The good news is the folder that's on the desktop is actually just an alias. If you look at it, it's an alias for the actual folder, which is in the user's shared folder, and it's called Relocated Items. So you definitely can safely just remove the alias. That's not going to do anything. But you might want to keep those files around for a little while, just in case you actually need them. Like my customized Apache configuration file, I wanted that. So get it off the desktop, fine. If you go through the folder and you decide, I really don't need any of these items floating around, yeah, it's totally safe to delete it at that point. You can just trash it. For me, I'm going to be keeping mine in the user's shared relocated items location at least for a couple months, maybe even 6 months, a year. I don't really know. But because they just don't take up a lot of space, they're not really bothering me. You can kind of put them out of sight, out of mind, and then just leave them there. And then if you suddenly realize you need them or you have an application that's behaving strangely or something like that, at least you can go check. I also did a little research. You know, just Google some of the items you don't understand in there, and you can usually figure out what they're for and then kind of make an informed decision on whether or not you need that. I think in a lot of cases, again, you're going to find this is related to old software that you had installed way back when, and they're probably not needed anymore. But that's what they're all about, and that's what's going on. Another thing I think somewhat related that came up this week, although I don't think this is happening to as many people, I had a listener who found something called pre-boot folders. Chuck found three of these folders named pre-boot, pre-boot 1, and pre-boot 2 in the root of his installation drive after upgrading from macOS Mojave to Catalina. And so Chuck had emailed me to ask, what are these folders and why are they there? And I started looking into it because I had really no idea what pre-boot folders were. I didn't have any of them on my Mac, so I suspected that maybe they weren't something that was definitely created by the Catalina install, although it may be possible. When I looked it up, it turned out that preboot is responsible for booting tasks, which kind of makes sense. And when you bless an Apple file system volume, an APFS volume, when it's created, you're also configuring a preboot volume in the container to support booting. There seems to be mixed opinions, though, on whether or not you can delete these, because Chuck was basically asking, why do I have all these and can I delete them? And probably the OS may not even let you delete them from the research that I was doing. And you might not want to, since it does control booting. Some people say that if you actually delete them from your drive, then your drive might not boot, which could be bad. I kind of sort of equate this to like deleting the kernel file back in the Mac OS 9 to 10 transition days when you could run in classic mode. You used to be able to go into classic mode and you would see over there the Mac OS kernel file. It wasn't hidden from the file system in Mac OS 9. And there were a lot of cases of people going in deleting that kernel file because they found it annoying sitting there. And they're like, what is this? And you just trash it. And then suddenly your Mac wouldn't boot at all into Mac OS 10. So these preboot files, they seem like they might be needed. Why you have three of them? I have a feeling that something is recreating them, maybe multiple upgrades or something like that. And like I said, I don't have any of these on my system. So this one's still a little bit of a mystery to me. I couldn't figure out why they were there, but I wanted to bring it up because Chuck found them, and there might be other Mac users out there, others of you out there, who have run into these pre-boot volumes at all. Again, I'd kind of just leave them there and try to do a little bit more research to figure out what they are. Although, like I said, I didn't find a lot of details in my research, which is why I'm bringing it up here on the MacCast, because guess what? We have an incredibly smart and intelligent community that can usually figure this stuff out. So if you happen to know what this is all about, why some people are seeing these preboot folders, I would imagine they're normally something that should be hidden by the operating system. It sounds like they get created by APFS, which would be a good thing. So Chuck, for you, I would say leave them there for now, and hopefully on a future episode of the MacCast, we'll have somebody follow up and give us a little more information. I'll keep digging as well. I just didn't have a ton of time to dig into this one, but I did want to bring it up, and just in case someone in our community had an idea for what those were. But there's some little things that you might run into after upgrading to Mac OS Catalina. Specifically, I really wanted to address this relocation folder because I know from all the emails that a lot of you were very concerned about it. I wanted to give you a reminder about the new reminders in Mac OS Catalina, mostly because this was something that I totally forgot about and wish somebody had reminded me about. What I'm talking about, in case you're really confused at this point, is that when you launch reminders in iOS or Mac OS Catalina after upgrading to iOS 13 or Mac OS Catalina, you are going to see a message about the new reminders and the need to upgrade the reminders in your iCloud account. This is if you use iCloud syncing. And that's because it has changed quite a bit. And what you need to know about this before you say yes is that you need to make sure that all of your iOS devices and your Mac devices can run iOS 13 or Mac OS Catalina. Because if you choose to upgrade the reminders in your iCloud account, any devices that don't support those operating systems will not be able to access and share in the shared reminders. All of your devices and any people that you have shared reminders with are in the same boat. So this is another important thing. If you're sharing your reminders with other folks and they might be on older devices or older versions of the operating system, everybody needs to be on the same version of the operating system to be able to participate in the new reminders. So luckily, in most cases, the operating system will pop up and tell you and warn you about this change. They give you a pretty good message, and there's a lot of details there. And you can make that decision whether or not you want to upgrade or not. But definitely do not upgrade if you rely on iCloud syncing for reminders, and again, if you have older devices that can't be upgraded. And it will even list out, I think, which devices you have if you've registered them with Apple and with iCloud, which devices that you have that are okay, and which ones are potentially not okay. For me, it was sort of a bummer because I have an older MacBook Air that can't be upgraded to macOS Catalina, so it would be out of being able to be synced with my reminders should I upgrade. If you do upgrade and you do have older devices and Macs, then after the upgrade, your only option if you want to use reminders with the synced data would be to actually go to iCloud.com and log in on the website. So wanted to give everybody a reminder about that. And then lastly, I wanted to tell you something about this that listener Jeff pointed out in an email to me. If you're running watchOS 6, there is no option to upgrade without being forced to the new reminder system. So it does not give you a warning on watchOS 6, and it could potentially upgrade your reminders to the new system. So be careful there, because again, once you've upgraded to the new system in iCloud, you're not going to be able to sync with some of your older devices. And so just watch out on Apple Watch. I don't know why Apple gives you this great warning on macOS Catalina and in iOS the first time you launch the Reminders app, but they don't if you launch the Reminders app on watchOS 6. So thanks, Jeff, for warning us about that. And there's your reminder about the new reminders. I guess it is October and we're getting closer to Halloween, so we probably should close out the MacCast with a little bit of a scary story, or one of the scary stories that keeps me up at night and keeps me worried. I'm always worried about a certain kind of email winding up in my inbox. And unfortunately this week, James sent me one of those dreaded listener emails. Basically, it comes down to, quote, "My dad lost all his files on his iMac due to a hard drive failure, and he had no backup." Yes, folks, the biggest, most scariest thing in my life is people without backup. You know, I harp on this, and I only harp on it because I really think everyone should do it, because I don't like hearing about data loss. Data loss is horrible. It's a horrible thing to go through. And I don't want anybody to suffer from it. So I only say this to help and protect you. Please back up, help your friends and family back up, show them how easy it is, and get them convinced that it is a good thing to do, because it definitely is. And I know I harp on this and say everyone should do it, but I also understand the reality that not everybody does. And James, I feel for you and I feel for your dad. It really sucks to lose your data. Luckily, there are ways to do recovery. I think recovery sucks for a lot of reasons, and we're going to talk about one of them here in a minute. But you can sometimes recover from a hard drive failure if you're lucky. We've discussed recovery options and apps on the MacCast in the past, and luckily James's dad was able to recover many of the files that he lost on his drive using a recovery tool. I don't know which one he used, but we've talked about ones like Disk Drill from Clever Files or Data Rescue from ProSoft Engineering. They're great applications. They're expensive. They often can't recover everything, but they are an option should you or someone you know find themselves in this situation. Of course, you can also send it out to a place like Drive Savers, but that's going to cost you a lot of money. We're talking, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of dollars to do data recovery. And the problem with data recovery that a lot of people don't tell you about or talk about too much, and I don't even think I've talked about here on the MacCast, is that there's a problem when the data comes back. And this specifically leads us to James's question. When you get the data recovered, the recovery often happens into one giant volume or folder of all of your recovered files, and all of those files typically don't have their original file names or folder structure with them. So basically what you get is a giant dump. Imagine if it was a giant dump of every file, and by every file, I do mean every file that was on your hard drive. So this includes configuration files, settings, stuff inside application folders, inside application packages, including all of their assets, like their graphics, their images, all those sorts of things. And now imagine all of those things jumbled in with your personal files and information and photos and audio recordings and all those sorts of things. And not only that, every single file name is just file 001. .pdf, file 005.jpg, file 1278, .png or .doc or .pdf or whatever it might be. So now you've got an entire massive volume, and you know the size of hard drives these days, right? With gigabytes and gigabytes of just random files. And now you have the task of having to go through, look and figure out which ones are your important documents and files and which ones are things that you don't need or don't care about. It is a giant nightmare. And this is the nightmare facing James's dad. So again, James, I totally feel for you. These files can be from any place. And so what James was asking is there anything we can do to make this process easier? Is there any tools that can help here? Because the problem is you don't get any of your structure or the underlying metadata that goes with all these files. Unfortunately, James, I think really in most cases, you're going to have to wade through the individual files. The only thing that I could think of was that maybe there were some tools that could help divide the data and the files automatically into smaller containers or buckets that make sense. So for example, a big concern often is photos, right? Your photo files and your image files. Chances are the actual full-size ones versus, say, the thumbnails that might be stored are going to be of a certain size and larger, and they're going to be in certain image formats, probably most likely JPEG or one of Apple's new HEIC formats, whatever it might be. And so if you could find an app that would maybe go through the folder and look based on certain parameters, sort of filter the files into buckets that you could go through a little bit more easily. And so I did some searching, some Google searching, because I didn't know about any apps like this. And I came across an app called Spotless from Lightpillar. It actually is part of SetApp. So I've talked about SetApp before in the past. That's the subscription application service from the folks at MacPaw. I am a huge SetApp fan. You pay $10 a month and you get access to all kinds of tools and utilities. And this one is in there. You, of course, can just buy it directly from Lightpillar as well. But what this app will do is it's designed typically to be an auto tidying tool for your desktop and for your Mac. So you can define locations or you can drop items onto it or a folder of items onto it, and then you can set up rules for where you want those files to go. So depending upon how they're named, what their dates are, what their file sizes are, what their file formats are, it will then take everything that you sort of feed it and shuffle it off into designated locations that you set up. So I kind of think that for your dad, maybe he could use a tool like this, dump all of these files into it, and then say, hey, look, if it's a JPEG and it's of this size, go ahead and put it in this folder. And if it's a Word document, then I want it over here. And if it's a PDF, I want it over there. And that might make the task a little less daunting. And you could also say, well, if it's a configuration file or if it's a plist file or some other kind of file that I really don't care about, put it over in this bucket. So that might be something that you could do. I also imagine a tool like Hazel might be able to do something similar. So that was my first thought, is separate the files into smaller sort of collections that will be easier to sift through. That's what I came up with. I don't know what you and our community might have or know about. I don't know about any tools, and this would be ideal, any tools that could actually recover the file structure or the folder structure, and I just don't know that any exist. I think in this kind of recovery situation, all of that stuff, at least in my experience, is just lost, but maybe there's something out there obscure that I just haven't heard of that somebody in our community knows about, or maybe there's some other tools, or maybe somebody has been through this before and found a way to make the process a little bit easier. So if you are one of those people, and you have something you can share with us, please do send me an email, an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com, because I'm sure I'm missing something. But again, my heart goes out to you, James, and hopefully you can use this as an opportunity to work with your dad and convince him of the value of backup. I really feel like there's no reason for anybody who owns a Mac to not at least have Time Machine backups running. You know, get a USB hard drive. My rule of thumb, double the size of your internal drive. So if you have a 1 terabyte internal drive, just get a USB 3, 2 terabyte drive. You probably can get one for under $100. Plug it into that Mac, and when it says, do you want to use this for Time Machine, say yes. That's it. You're backed up. You have at least one form of backup. I would argue you want a lot more. You probably want an offsite. You probably want a secondary backup, but start with one because it's so easy. And then you have it, and you'll never have to, or very likely never have to, find yourself in this situation again. And thank you for sharing your story, because I think it's important that we have these conversations, that we talk about it, and we understand these things do happen. It's not a horrible thing. We're not shaming anybody here. It's just we don't want our friends and family to suffer through not having backups. And when they do, we want to help them out. So hopefully this helps you out, James, and thank you again for your email. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, also Text Expander for iOS, and PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad. You can get more information and details on all of their great software by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CashFly. You can find them at CACHEFLY.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I like hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, or even if you just want to say hi, shoot me an email, an audio comment. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes with links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast. But that'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.